Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Don't bug me, okay? I've been talking about 3 hours ago with a very condescending lawyer, and it's just, I've let it run away with me. You've had days like that. Tonight, we're going to introduce a new feature, and starting from that frame of mind makes it an excellent time to start the new feature called Under the Hammer. When we have interview and news, it's going to be at the end of the news. When we have only an interview, it's going to be before the interview. Tonight, the first installment of Under the Hammer. The organization that has stepped in the deep doo-doo this time is a Hamilton landlord. If you've been listening to the show for the last year and a half, 18 months ago, we talked about a woman who had an apartment overrun by mice. Her landlord wasn't doing anything about it, and she was beside herself. She had an anxiety disorder. She had some learning disabilities. She was working. She was supporting herself. But the city wouldn't do anything, and the landlord wouldn't do anything. And yes, full disclosure, she is known to the show. 18 months later, most of the mice are gone, probably thanks to disrespect. Now she's still living with all her things in boxes, breaking out all over in welts. She and her social worker feel her immune system has been compromised because she's tired all the time. She can't remember things clearly. If you've had mice, you may be aware that they leave behind huge amounts of urine and pellets, and that these are toxic. In fact, they may even be fatally dangerous with some species of mice. At any rate, she's going to see her doctor and find out what really might be going on. This is the landlord's responsibility to rectify. The landlord is doing nothing. In fact, a branch of the landlord also runs a city housing waiting list. She's asked for a subsidy on a one-bedroom apartment because her earnings are very low. And she's asked for a balcony, which because of her anxiety disorder, she requires to get outside the apartment walls sometimes. She's also asked a Christian housing organization to find such an apartment for her. She's been offered by the Christian organization an apartment without a balcony. That was perhaps 6 months ago. She's been offered by the organization linked to her landlord a bachelor apartment. We're hoping it doesn't take too long to find among the many apartments being vacated in Hamilton an apartment suitable for this woman. I'm so deserving because she could be on Ontario Disability Support Plan, but instead she works and she gets back disrespect. She is Under the Hammer. This week on Disrespect, I'm going to introduce you to Sam Sansalone. He's an advocate for disabled children, and he has a severely disabled daughter of his own who last year won the award for happiest girl in her school. Sam was involved in the case of baby Joseph. You may recall from the papers the newborn who was finding it hard to get home from a London hospital and had to be shipped to the United States, which was the only place who would actually perform the surgery this disabled child needed before he could go home with his family. Now that Joseph is, in fact, at home with his family, Sam talks to us about the details of that experience. It's potentially hair-raising, but not the kind of conversation that would put you off listening to it. Here is Sam. What was the first concrete indication you had that told you that the hospital might have other than the baby's best interests at heart? And what did it point to?
I don't know if this was the very first concrete basis that was presented to me, but it was certainly the most dramatic one.
Okay.
When I had arranged to get some surveillance photos of the settings on the ventilator machine.
All right.
The hospital at that point was preventing the family from even taking pictures or video.
Okay.
And it was pretty evident to me that that was because they didn't want us to know what was really going on, including on the ventilator machine setting. So we arranged it anyway. I arranged for someone to get some images of that.
When you say you arranged it, what did that entail? I mean, how aware were the hospital?
Zero.
Okay.
They had no awareness.
Okay.
They would have prevented it, I'm quite sure, at that point.
All right.
What we had to do is get at least something that was compelling enough as evidence, then they would look too ridiculous to continue preventing the family from taking photos or videos. They stopped the family from taking videos after the family had published on the internet some video coverage that suggested Joseph was not in a persistent vegetative state.
Okay.
And I had shown some of this coverage, some of these video clips actually, even to some physicians had seen it, and one of them, whom I respect a great deal, was quite stunned by what he had seen in those video images. But what, getting back to your question, the thing that really struck me was when we got back an image, it was a still image initially, as well as a not a very good video, of the machine settings. And there's one setting on the machine that's labeled as SIMV.
All right.
Sierra, India, and then MV. And what that tells you is how much the baby's initiating breaths on his own, basically.
Okay.
And we were stunned to find out that we knew he was breathing on his own to a degree, but we didn't know it was to this degree. That the photograph proved that the settings on the machine were such that this baby, out of previous 60 breaths, was taking at least 55 of them on his own, at least,
okay.
If not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
The SIMV was set such that the machine would assist only 5
okay.
out of those 60 at the most. That was stunning to not just myself. I remember the physician that I sent it to in the U.S., I emailed him this image, this photograph, and he came back, and I think his jaw almost dropped when we saw it, the way he described it, and he took the picture over to some of his colleagues, and they were discussing it, and they were stunned that this was a baby that was being described the way he was being described.
And had been on a ventilator how long?
At that point, it would have been, close to about 3 months.
Right.
It was close to 3 months.
And obviously and, not needing one.
Well, at that point, certainly he was initiating most of the breaths on his own, but when you have a baby on a ventilator for that long, if he didn't need it, but you kept him on, what the machine does, you see, what it does is even if you initiate the breath on your own, the machine could assist
okay.
in completing the breath.
All right.
And so it causes the baby's intercostal muscles, and I think the diaphragm as well, the muscles that are associated with the breathing process, it causes them to basically atrophy.
All right.
They lose their tone. So if the baby could have breathed completely on his own without any ventilator support, that would have been compromised anyway by keeping him on the ventilator for this long. So what you have to do, if you're sensible and you really want to do what's in the best interest of the child, if they can breathe on their own, is you now have to get them off the ventilator, but you can't just shut it off because you potentially made a very stupid error in leaving them on as long as you did.
Right.
And that, so you have to wean them off in a very prescribed kind of manner.
Okay.
And in steps. And you do it very carefully with observation and with a very clear strategy. And what that will involve is potentially days to, usually if it could be even 5 days or so, but if the baby's been on a long time, it could take weeks. I've heard of
Okay.
So in Joseph's case, I think it was just 3 weeks, if I'm not mistaken,
All right.
that it took once they started weaning him.
Right. So he could build up these muscles again.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if you're a doctor or a department that doesn't subscribe to that way of thinking, you might not even have the experience to know
how long, but
not how long you should give the kid a chance before you write him off.
Okay.
I think probably a lot of doctors would have written him off sooner, but I know one of the people I involved in Joseph's case, who's a phenomenal doctor for these kinds of purposes, Dr. Paul Byrne of Ohio, Toledo, Ohio. He's the one, more than anyone else who was involved that I was speaking to anyway, who explained, you know, just how long this could take and should be permitted to take
before
the average person might give up. And I was actually quite surprised when Dr. Byrne was telling me how long he has seen a ventilator weaning process take before the kid actually did manage to become completely independent of the ventilator again. It was quite surprising to me. I didn't know that it wasn't so unusual in his experience that a kid can go on for many weeks to regain their tone. I thought the answer would come sooner, but, you know,
right.
true enough, to his very enlightened prediction, it happened. I think it was just about 3 weeks with Joseph. It wasn't even that much longer than the usual period. I think the usual period is 5 or 6 days
that they
give.
Okay.
I'm not even sure about that.
Okay, so you're faced with the realization that the hospital certainly wasn't demonstrating that they had the baby's best interest at heart, let's put it that way. But to take it right back to the beginning, how did you get drawn into this? I mean, I know you've acquired something of a reputation of a defender of disabled children, starting from your own experience with your daughter. But what was it? Was it a call in the middle of the night? Was it an email, a text,
almost.
Friend?
I remember this year has been very busy for referral cases. Even before Joseph, I was surprised at how much was happening in cases that were becoming public or somewhat public, and I would get involved in them. You know, people would come to me and tell me, or I'd find out about these cases. And in this case, I remember being so tired from, I think there were two or three cases that had happened in the previous month and a half or so, and I was glad that there was not another case
right.
I was having to deal with. And I told myself one night, I'm going to sleep in the next morning, and I'm not even going to get up for work, because I have to get up pretty early for work when I'm in Alberta, because I work with stocks and in the investing business, and the stock market opens 9:30 Eastern time, but 7:30 Mountain time, and I have to get up before that to find out what's happening in the market and make decisions and strategize how I'm going to conduct my business day, if I have to do anything at all. And I remember the night before I got the call about Joseph, I told myself, okay, I'm going to just sleep in. I'm going to do nothing tomorrow morning. I'm going to give myself a day of rest.
All right.
And not a chance.
Okay.
Early, I can't remember what time it was, but it was pretty annoyingly early, I guess. I got a call from someone in my network who said, Sam, the child who was in that legal case, they've lost the case, that they're going to pull the tube or something like that. And I was in a half-sleep state, groggy, trying to wake up and thought, oh, no, I just can't do this today. But it's hard to say no,
mm-hmm.
because you just never know if there's something that can be done. And it sounded pretty grim, actually, at that point. So I told this person.
So they'd been
okay.
to court, right? Is that what
yeah.
happened? Okay.
And I had not been following it, because
okay.
this other person in my network was following it.
All right.
And they had initially told me, I think 2 weeks before, they had sent me an email saying, here's a potential new case or whatever.
All right.
And they gave me a link to a newspaper article. And I thought, well, that sounds like a very awful position for a family to be in. This was earlier before the crap hit the fan for this situation. So what I did at that point, I think I sent an email, if I remember correctly, to the writer of the article in the London Free Press, and I said, if it's of any use to the family, I could probably connect them with a physician in the U.S. who might be able to help them. It was a very brief email, and I just left it. I never heard back from the reporter, the writer, and I actually forgot about it, because I remember when I got that call early in the morning of the day that I decided to rest. I remember that I completely forgotten about this thing. I just left it in the hands of the newspaper article writer, which was a stupid thing for me to do now that I think of it. Mm-hmm. But I had just been distracted by so many other things since. Mm-hmm. So I get this call early in the morning, and I agree. I say, okay, I really don't have a lot of time to do much today, but I'll see what I can do. I'll make some calls. I'll start trying to make some calls to see if I can reach the family.
Okay.
So having no intention of or expectation that I would be drawn into what was about to ensue, because it sounded from the description that it was already pretty dismal. The first person I called, as I looked at the article and I looked at who the lawyer's name was that was representing the family, so I called him to find out what was going on. And
Eastern lawyer, right? Like the family.
That's correct. The family's lawyer. It was the first lawyer they had. I think it might have been one of these situations where you get subsidized legal consultations or something like that.
Okay.
Anyway, I didn't know at the time that he had done a miserable job.
Okay.
Of taking care of this case, I didn't know. So I called him and just told them that there was a possibility that I could put them in touch with some U.S. doctors that could help. And would he like to, offer that to the family? I don't know what could be done, but is there anything that might be helpful for, given what he told me, which was that it looked like a fait accompli, like there was not much they were going to be able to do legally.
Right.
So without getting into too much detail, for about half of the rest of that day, I was giving this guy more and more opportunities to do something meaningful with the information I gave him. And I became increasingly concerned with how non-proactive he was being with the opportunity. So I decided that I'm going to try to reach the family directly and not tell the lawyer, because I want to see what's really going on behind the scenes. I wasn't about to trust this lawyer too much, because I just wasn't impressed with the way he was responding to the opportunities I was giving. It didn't seem like he was
aggressive enough.
Well, I wish I could put it that nicely.
With a break from the story, right now, Steve Dawson, Fairweather Friends.
Spark from the rail flies like a bullet from an old gun barrel. We left before we could make amends, the stolen words and fair weather friends. So long to those that we left behind, we took what we needed, the rest entwined in mysteries that are impossible to crack. And now I won't be coming back. Years go by, but only now it's clear. If I could only break you out of rise every day. I won't look back as the light leaves the sky, but I'll keep my enemies close by. Years go by, but only now. tattered and worn like the clothes on my back, and I'll fend off every attack. The years go by, but only now it's clear. If I could only break you out of here. The years go by, but only now it's clear. If I could only break you out of
searching, where else this was appearing, and I saw that there was this Facebook group, and it wasn't huge at that point. It was big, but it was nowhere near the size it was about to become. In the couple weeks that ensued, I looked for someone who appeared to be a relative, and I couldn't tell from names because I couldn't find someone with that last name. But I found someone who spoke in a context that sounded like they could be related.
All right.
I can't remember if there was, I think there was just the one. I think I didn't have to go more than the one. And I private messaged that person on Facebook. I couldn't email them. I didn't have their email address at that point. So their particular Facebook profile had that enabled. So I was able to, as a member of the public, private message them. I introduced myself, didn't get into too much detail. I told them that there's a chance I might be able to help by getting some other physicians involved from a more neutral perspective. Mm-hmm. And would that be helpful? Are you related to the family that you could pass this message on to them?
Mm-hmm.
And I got an email back saying, yes, they were related. So then I gave more information and said that I'd been in touch with the lawyer earlier in the day, and I was concerned with how that dialogue was going, and I didn't know that I should fully trust it. So I thought I ought to get a channel opened up, a channel of communication opened up to the family in case they were wanting me to intervene in any way.
Okay.
With what I had at my disposal. So this person became quite excited at the prospect and said basically yes, that they were gonna pursue making a connection, but they didn't want to get the mother's hopes up so high because she was really suffering.
All right.
And didn't want to bring your hopes up only for them to come down.
Okay.
So as the day developed, they found out more about me. I didn't actually even have time to tell them much, but I told them, if you Google my name, you'll probably find out what I do and how I've been able to help. So I presume that's what they did, because it wasn't long before I was getting communication back where they were very eager to get my assistance.
Oh, good.
So what I did at that point, after I contacted the family more directly, Within about 28 hours or so, 28, 29 hours of first getting that call in my sleep-deprived state that Friday morning, I basically convinced the family to not trust this lawyer, to get rid of him,
Wow.
find another lawyer, and had them agree in principle to a plan I had developed. And my plan that I developed was rather than struggle here, they were having such a struggle here trying to persuade the hospital. I knew enough at that point, by that time, about the kid's background to know that he had visited a hospital in the U.S. in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So I told them, why don't we just pursue getting him to get a second opinion in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
where we're more isolated from this Ontario healthcare system that is really going to be a stumbling block for you no matter where you go, because throughout what I try to teach this family is it's not the London hospital on its own that you have to be concerned about. It'll be the Ministry of Health, which is Ontario-wide.
Right.
It's, these kinds of decisions that affect these kinds of children come from, a systemic implementation.
Okay.
You can't just point to the hospital. And you can't expect to go to another Ontario a hospital and get a different, a truly objective, independent second opinion. So within a day or so of less than a day, I just not only did I convince them to get rid of this lawyer and find another one, but I also came up with this simple strategy: just take the kid to the U.S. And since he's already been to Detroit, I explained to the family this gives them certain rights at that hospital to bring him back. He's already a patient.
Okay.
He's already got physicians there.
All right.
And the reason why this fortuitous situation existed is because the family lived in Windsor, and they are literally only, I think it's 8 minutes to the U.S., to the Children's Hospital of Michigan in Detroit, which is much closer than any Canadian pediatric facility for them.
There isn't one in Windsor, eh?
No.
Okay.
Not a pediatric facility.
All right.
There's not a Children's Hospital in Windsor.
Okay.
And there probably won't need to be because there's an arrangement that's made with the Ontario Ministry of Health that allows Windsor area pediatric patients, their families, can take their children over the border.
Oh, good.
To get services there, and it'll be covered by OHIP.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it's probably a pretty neat arrangement, actually.
All right.
So this was my initial strategy with the family. Get rid of the lawyer.
Yeah.
Let's find someone who will do a proper job, hopefully, and fast. And at the same time, let me try to get you into the U.S. Let me try to get Joseph into the U.S. instead of struggling here. Why struggle here? I said, why? Why? I didn't understand. There was no need. He's already got a hospital opportunity there, and they didn't realize that. Hadn't thought that there was that opportunity.
So this was the beginning of parting of the ways with the Ontario medical system.
As far as, from my involvement, yeah, but they were already well parted long before I came there.
All right.
I think the Ontario, when I examine the history and, my explication of how this developed would have it that the parting of ways happened in November.
Right.
Before any of us knew about
it. So what
happened
in November?
The child was admitted. Well, I should just tell you one more thing before we go on to that subject. Within one day of that event where I got the families
on side,
they came on side with my plan to get him to a U.S. hospital. Within one day of that, I'm not exaggerating. I'm pretty sure it was that Sunday. Yeah, it was that Sunday night. I had in writing a commitment from the U.S. hospital that they were going to accept Joseph. So a lot of to-do has been made about finding Joseph a hospital, but actually it was done within that would have been 55 hours or so of me first getting involved.
Okay.
And then the reason why it became so much of an issue after that is because within 3 days of that, the U.S. hospital came under pressure, and I don't know how much of that I can tell you publicly here, but they came under pressure to rescind their agreement.
Oh.
Yeah, and that there will be a point in time where I can be more open about this, but I'm pretty appalled by how that happened. I can tell you that. And I will tell you this much, that I know from inside sources that the decision to squash that first opportunity that was given for Joseph to go to a U.S. hospital came not from the normal channel level. It came from a very high executive level in the hospital.
Okay.
And I have evidence that it wasn't just the Detroit hospital that was involved in that. So to give you a more sort of an encapsulation of what I said in a more meaningful way, the decision to accept Joseph occurred within just two or three days.
Right.
By getting involved, and it was done by the proper channels at the doctor and departmental level in Michigan. It was done by the usual medical level, doctor level means. The decision 3 days after that to boot him out and not give him the opportunity did not come from that level. It came from an executive level, at a very high executive level in the Michigan hospital, and the Michigan hospital was highly highly influenced, if not pressured, to go in this direction by their partners in the Ontario medical system in Canada. Mm-hmm. And they are partnered. They are partnered in a number of ways, and not the least of which is what I just described earlier. There is an arrangement between this Detroit Children's Hospital and the Ontario Ministry of Health in Canada. There is an arrangement where Ontario sends business their way.
Yeah.
And Ontario gives that hospital lots of money to take care of Canadian children who are just minutes away over the border.
Right.
And I'm pretty appalled by how this was squashed. Then the next, two or three weeks was a matter of foiling Ontario Ministry of Health's further efforts to prevent us from getting into another hospital. So we had to foil their plans to foil ours, and we foiled them in the end.
Okay.
After they got us a few times, I'll tell you. But we learned each time.
Yeah.
Each time they disrupted or debacled one of our U.S. hospital opportunities by the most disgusting means I could have imagined. Untruthfulness, backdoor, channel communications, the complete misrepresentation of both Joseph's case and also the nature of his family.
All right.
These hospitals were being led to believe that this was a family that would be very difficult to work with, that
right.
they can expect. So basically, they described the parents as the kinds of parents who you can expect. If you take this kid in the U.S. in your hospital, expect to get a lawsuit from this family.
Right, yeah.
That was happening behind our backs.
Right.
I have information that I acquired from sources that we were able to, verify this information. And it's not just one source, and it's not just one state.
Okay.
We were able to, I got verification. I was able to verify this. Several different states, different physicians involved, different departments, and it was the same story happening over and over again. It was just appalling. I am literally disgusted with how the Ontario hospital system and healthcare system abused their access to communicating with U.S. hospitals.
All right.
In a most unprofessional and untruthful manner to try to foil every opportunity we developed to get them into a U.S. hospital after that Detroit one. But, like I said, we learned each time, and I figured out a set of principles I was going to use for who the hospital I was holding at the top of my list.
All right.
Because I kept getting referrals to hospitals. Some of them, were meaningfully referred. There was a specific person, a specific department, or a specific experience with this hospital. And then a lot of them were just, members of the public saying, I think this is a great hospital.
Okay.
Which, that wasn't necessarily too helpful because there are thousands of hospitals in the U.S. that
All right.
fit that description. What we need to do is we needed to find in a way that was going to bypass all this media mess that
okay.
we were dealing with and all the backroom unlawful discussions that were happening between the Ontario hospital system and the U.S. ones that were misleading the U.S. hospitals.
Well, you did find a way around the media, because very little of it appeared in the media, and all that did, I think, was favorable, wasn't it?
Well, actually, I couldn't say that. No, there very little appeared in the Canadian media,
right?
Relative to what was happening
right.
in the earlier stages, because, and I have evidence of this as well. They were intentionally snuffing out the media opportunities. I'll give you a couple stories about that if you like in a minute. But the U.S. media latched onto this.
It wasn't
too long before they did.
Take a break with Rita Chiarelli, a reflection on guilt and redemption, These Four Walls.
No name. is all I have. Oh, these four walls. Yeah, these four walls. Yeah, these four walls. I had a mother, a father too. You can't believe I was a lot like you. Cause all I are these four walls, these four walls, these four walls. I had a wife, I had a son, and they were hungry, and I had a gun. And I saw that him die. I took his life. His life took mine. Forgiveness, Lord. Forgiveness, Lord. On this earth don't come. Not till they lay it down. One side, one. So take me now, Lord. Take me now, Lord, cause all I have are these four walls, these four walls. Lord, on this earth don't come. Not till they lay you down one by one. Now take me now, Lord, cause all I have are these four walls, these four walls. All I have, all I have are these four walls.
The debate rages on in the U.S.
Yeah.
Privatized versus nationalized healthcare.
Right.
This is seen by many as a symptom of nationalized healthcare.
Okay.
And this sort of thing happens in the U.S. too. Don't get me wrong when I say that there's some truth to that, because I believe this happens pretty much everywhere.
All right.
Does it happen more in Canada? In some kinds of patients, yes, I have evidence of that. Does it happen? Is it easier for it to occur in Canada because of our nationalized or provincialized healthcare system? Yes, definitely. And the reason why is because we are blurring the accountability channels here.
Okay.
For example, the ministry that funds the healthcare system is the Ontario Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care. They are part of the province of Ontario.
Right.
They're part of the provincial government. that's the same non-arm's length entity that also pays for our justice system, our legal justice system. They also pay for our police, our correctional services system. They pay for the coroner's office.
You're painting a kind of Big Brother picture.
Well, that's if you want to use that word, I don't see why it wouldn't apply. I mean, that's what it is. There's one entity
has control of all these agencies.
Yeah, well, not only control, but think of them as being the accused. When you accuse a hospital or a doctor or a group of doctors of doing the sort of things they were doing to Joseph or Ashley, when you accuse them, for you to go to the justice system and say, I want to, you know, bring a complaint against this agency, this government agency that is, I think, is harming my child and not giving him fair access to health care. If you take it to the justice system, you're practically talking to the accused. The accused becomes the judge and the jury and the executioner.
Right.
Everybody's rolled into one. Sure, they're different agencies, but they're non-arm's length relationships.
Okay.
There's no arm's length relationship at all between healthcare, between justice and law enforcement. There's just no arm's length relationship. So, of course, in a situation like that, the deterrent factor of clear accountability channels, that you lose that.
Okay.
So, in the U.S., where you have a privatized healthcare system, that can happen to a degree as well, but not to the same degree and not as extensively. Now, that doesn't mean their system is great either. I mean, I think their system's terrible, as it is. There are people dying in the street because they don't have healthcare insurance.
Right.
It's just appalling.
But at least it's clear where the buck stops if you can engage the system.
It's more often clear. I couldn't say it's completely clear, but it's more often clear. So you have at least that advantage in a privatized system. Now, should that mean that they should go over to, public health care or not? I think the debate's a lot more complicated than that, and I don't want to get into the political issues, but I can tell you that I am certain from my experience, not just with my daughter, you know, over the decade that I've had to deal with her in this kind of a system, but also in all the other cases I've dealt with, and there have been a fair number where access to medical services gets into a dubious situation of it not being equitable, you know, to people of disadvantage, like disabled neonates and elderly people. I am sure that if the U.S. wants to go nationalized, just make sure they ought to really make sure they just don't copy what we've got, like, do something completely different. Make it nationalized if you must, or if you want to, if it's going to be advantageous for more people. But don't copy everything we're doing here, because we've been doing it for over 50 years and learn from our mistakes.
Okay.
You know, we've got 5 decades of experience with this.
Yeah.
Look at what look where it's not working and innovate. You're Americans, you know, like Canadians, like, innovate.
Yeah.
Do something different. Go ahead and nationalize if you must or want to, but do it in a way that's going to be different than ours. And what I had suggested when I met with some members of Congress and senators about that kind of area of legislative development in the U.S., because I was invited to speak under a congressional invitation on this subject in Washington. And what I suggest to them is, there are a couple things, but In a nutshell, I'd put it this way. If you're going to nationalize, you have to specifically name the vulnerable groups in that kind of a system, which include people like disabled babies and elderly people. You have to specifically name them in the legislation and incorporate specific protections for them, for them specifically.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that in our legislation, not in any clear form. We do not have that in our legislation. Because
right.
I kept getting this argument, this counter-argument back from the U.S. when I was, you know, warning them of areas where they have to be wary of if they go nationalized in their health care. I kept getting this thing back, well, I've looked at the, you know, proposals in someone would say, and I haven't seen anything that discriminates against disabled babies or elderly people.
Right.
And I'm thinking, oh, brother, of course there's not going to be legislation that discriminates against them. It's not the existence of bad legislation that you have to worry about. It's the absence of adequate legislation that's
right.
going to specifically protect the specific vulnerable groups. And they, I don't know why, but a lot of people just don't seem to get that. To me, that's very simple.
Well, you need to engage people from the vulnerable groups, and once you've done that, then uh-huh. you, at least you've got people who understand the situation. And I don't think that'll be difficult in the case of the disabled. It might be more difficult in the case of the elderly, but it might not. It's America.
Well,
and,
one thing,
and that's
got,
the baby boom, you know, coming up.
That's what, sorry?
That's the baby boom coming up. When you talk of the elderly, give it another 10 years. It's the baby boom, and the baby boom happened sooner in the States than here. So it's a very large group of very active elderly.
Yeah, and I do remember, like, even growing up, this was a big area of concern of how could we possibly afford to take care of the baby boomers as they aged?
Mm-hmm.
Where are we going to get the money to do this? Mm-hmm. There's going to be so many people and not enough money. It's valid concerns. You know, I may be rationing. People may not like it when I say this, but I do believe in rationing if it's necessary, but I don't believe in implementing it inequitably. So if we have to ration, then we all suffer. You know, we don't pick certain groups and say the ones where we're going to suffer are the elderly or the disabled babies because we can get away with it with them. That's wrong. If we have to ration, fine, we ration. Unfortunately, but we do it equitably. We're all humans. We have equal human rights.
Well, what's emerging is the baby boom is the healthiest, longest-lived generation the world has yet seen. And so a lot of these fears are proven to be distant rather than at our doorstep, as they would have been had life expectancies and health standards been what they were probably when it was initiated in the 50s.
Well, there you go.
So I guess.
There's one good strategy there. Make sure the people who are getting older are healthier older people
mm-hmm.
instead of sick, you know, sickly older people.
And apparently more knowledgeable, too, about their care. Not, I'm saying authorities, but more knowledgeable. They're more willing to challenge their doctor. Sometimes it's only with a page pulled off the internet of doubtful provenance, but sometimes it's also with peer-reviewed studies that the doctor is glad to have and consider. It's a very different generation that is growing old today.
It is. I guess this is not really precedented as far as we can tell.
No,
in history.
That's for sure. So, you have your right to posit solutions to hypothetical questions, and your right to consider that there may be more than one question or more than 10 involved in how to meet this challenge. We just dealt with that in the national election, didn't we? Presumably. I didn't hear any strategies, though.
Well, here's the thing. I don't think we've got, I doubt we have a full solution of how we can fiscally afford to be an ethical society. But I don't doubt that we can find a way. I mean,
I've heard that Medicare is as adequate as you want it to be. You know, pony up. If you want it to be adequate when you get there, pony up. Make it adequate now.
Well, and another way to also look at it, I guess, is I think I've mentioned this to you before, perhaps even on the show. I think that this principle applies that necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah.
And if you keep letting people get away with killing disabled babies.
Yeah.
Quickly accelerating the death of older people who are not contributing to the GDP anymore.
Right.
If we continue institutionally to allow that to happen, then we won't quite stress the system enough and place an over-demand on the system enough to force people to come up with better ideas about how to address it. So,
or to reward people sufficiently for coming up with better ideas. The work won't be seen as valuable as it is.
So let's get scared about how on earth we're going to fulfill the budget, you know, for being ethical and treating our elderly people and the disabled babies and other vulnerable patients. Let's let's treat them as they deserve, not pretend, you know, we're doing so, and in reality, we're just killing them off. let's stop that nonsense. Let's be ethical, see where the cards fall, and then just deal with it. And you will see the human spirit rise out of that desperation and challenge. We will see it rise to create solutions.
Oh yeah.
So that we can afford. I am sure we can afford to do it. And
I saw one example in the news this week. They've been using a very expensive cancer drug, which costs thousands per administration to treat certain kinds of cancers, and they found out that Avastin will do exactly the same job with the same odds of recovery for costs of administration in the double digits instead of in four
wow.
figures. And that kind of insight and that kind of courage to speak out is needed now.
Well, there you go. And there's two things you've identified right there. So there's efficiency and there's weeding out the waste, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Just those two things alone, we could probably put a whole bunch of really smart minds to those tasks and come up with things that are going to, and they're already doing that, I'm sure, to a degree, but make it more desperate. Make it more desperate. Don't let them believe that they're going to be able to keep killing off the disabled babies and accelerating the deaths of the elderly. Don't let them believe that anymore. Make them believe that, okay, you're going to need more money because we're not going to let you do this anymore to the vulnerable patients.
Yeah.
So you better get ready, and then see what kind of further ideas come out. I don't think they've scratched the surface of how they can make our healthcare delivery system more fiscally efficient and cut out the fat. I'll bet they hardly scratched the surface. That alone, and that's not on top of, and that's, you know, without even considering the paradigm shift kind of innovations that might come.
Okay.
To make healthcare more affordable to a government.
On that note, do you think we've reached an interesting point where we can talk about it later and come back at it?
Sure.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to do that. I haven't had my supper yet anyway.
Okay.
So we've had literally, I think, I've had nine cases just since Joseph, safely to the U.S. Since he got to the U.S. safely. He's now back in Canada, but I wasn't involved much after he got to the U.S. My mission, my job, you know, officially mandated by the family, and I was given decision-making power and all kinds of other control ability, I defined it for them, and they accepted it, and they gave me the power. I just had to get, my job was to get Joseph alive and well into a hospital that was going to care for him properly outside the geography of Canada. That was my job, so that was done. But since then, I've been utterly inundated with cases, and I just can't keep up with it. So
okay.
That's why I mentioned that.
All right.
I think it's relevant to know how much trouble there is out there.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be happening. But absolutely, let's continue another time.
And that's the first of what we hope are many installments to explain what I've called and can only call again a hair-raising experience getting this child out for the surgery he needs and then home, alive. To take us out, Rory Block, a song that's filled with light, Ancestral Home.
Speed upon the rocks and swaying from sorrow, sorrow. A big crowd of moon, sorrow, sorrow.
You mean a day, day,
out of the day, boats appear upon the wave. Wooden ships like floating graves.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.